The Naval's Council on World Affairs is pleased to welcome Michael Hanlon back to Naples. Welcoming Michael Hanlon back to Naples is a real pleasure, and I have to say he's almost an honorary member of the Council. And each time he's here, we come away with far more wisdom than when we arrived for his lecture. And I suspect that's going to happen again today when he addresses the way in which we, the United States, can, quote, escape the doomsday machine. So the question is, will it be on the Starship Enterprise, fighting a powerful planet-killing machine from another galaxy, or reliving Dr. Strangelove when actor Peter Sellers, as President Merkin Muffley, asks, the doomsday machine, what is that? But as a senior fellow for foreign policy for the 21st century security and intelligence at the Brookings Institution, I suspect the subject will be approached with the knowledge that Dr. O'Hanlon has accumulated these many years of serious research and will tell us how we can respond to possible limited attacks by the two great powers of Russia and China. So here to tell us is Dr. Michael O'Hanlon. Please welcome him.
Thank you, Mimi. Thank you, Mr. President. And if Father Murphy could only see me now, my childhood priest, finally in a pulpit, even if it's not a Catholic one. But I'm going to spare you the fire and brimstone speech that I was just trying to give, thinking of all the things I heard him say over the years, and get back to the doomsday machine at hand. And Mimi did an amazing job sort of conjuring up what I tried to do in this project. Unfortunately, I have to report that as good of a title as I thought we had with Escaping the Doomsday Machine, the book editors at Brookings wouldn't let me use it, ultimately. And I had to come up with a different one with the same idea. And so let me explain that, and then I'll get into the substance of the argument. But for those of you who might be interested in buying a Brookings book sometime around St. Patrick's Day or in April, the Senkaku Paradox will be available. And it's the same idea, the Senkaku Paradox, risking great power war over limited stakes. And let me explain what I mean. Some of you, I'm sure, are aware of what the Senkakus are. They are tiny, uninhabited islands in the Western Pacific Ocean claimed by both Japan and China. Japan is a U.S. treaty ally, as you're aware, and we have a mutual security treaty with Japan, which commits us to help Japan in its defense. The United States government does not have a position on whose islands the Senkakus really should be. And it doesn't even really matter much because no one lives there. Or as my colleague Jonathan Pollack likes to joke, the issue here is really about which language, Japanese or Chinese, the goats on the Senkaku Islands are going to be expected to speak. And yet, Chinese ships and aircraft have been increasingly operating in these waters within the 12-mile normal territorial limit of an island. There's even some dispute, however, as to whether these should qualify as islands, because under the Law of the Sea Treaty, which we respect but do not ratify or legally honor as a U.S. government, you have to be inhabitable to qualify as an island. But nonetheless, both sides are buzzing around, making mischief. The Japanese would say they're not making mischief because they've been the recognized owners of these islands for decades. The Chinese would say, no, you stole them back in the 19th century when you were stealing everything else in the region, and the Americans didn't make you give them back the way you had to give back Taiwan and half of our country after World War II. But we only now are powerful enough and strong enough to reopen the issue. The U.S. government, as I said, does not have a position on whose islands they should be, but we do feel obligated to come fight in defense of Japan's claim should the islands become a source of conflict. And President Obama said that personally. It had been American policy for previous presidencies as well, but Obama said it himself publicly, and Secretary Mattis, when he was still Secretary of Defense, reaffirmed it. So, to me, this is this amazing conundrum, and it's only one example of a broader category of problems that I want to talk about with you today, where we have little things really not worth fighting over, certainly not worth fighting a nuclear-armed superpower about, that could nonetheless kindle conflict. And what should we do? What should we do if one day we wake up and out of these 8 unoccupied, uninhabited Senkaku Islands, a couple hundred miles from China, a couple hundred miles from Okinawa, all of a sudden there's 100 Chinese troops ashore on one of them. And maybe they say, in classic Vladimir Putin style, and I'll get to Vladimir in a minute, don't worry, but with the kind of misinformation that the Russians these days are famous for, you know, we were just here to rescue a fisherman, or there was a Girl Scout or Boy Scout camping trip that went a little awry, and we're here to give them water, and we'll probably be leaving pretty soon, don't worry. What do we do? Well, I had had this scenario in the back of my mind for a number of years, and then I saw somebody in Japan ask the same question to the highest-ranking Marine general in the Western Pacific at that time. And some of you will know that I'm lucky enough, and you're lucky enough, some of you who have met John Allen, to be friends with that great Marine general, who's now also my boss at Brookings. The last time I was here 2 years ago, we were up on stage together, and he sends his greetings. Now he's the president of Brookings. That's retired 4-star General Allen, but retired 3-star General John Whistler, who had also been at Brookings for a year 20 years ago. He was the senior Marine that I'm talking about, and he was asked by a Japanese journalist, what would the United States do if the scenario that I just described were to play out? And General Whistler, about 4 years ago this happened, he said pretty much the only thing I believe he could have said, and I think it was exactly the right thing to say, but it might be exactly the wrong thing for us to do if this scenario actually happens, at least as our first response. He said, we should take the island back. Oh, that's very interesting. We're going to fight nuclear-armed China over an uninhabited island about which we don't even have an official government position concerning ownership. And this got me thinking, even though Whistler had no choice about what he said, because what's he going to say alternatively? Oh, sure, China, go ahead. We'll probably just file a diplomatic demarche and be done with it. Obviously, he had to reaffirm the commitment of the United States because President Obama at that time had already publicly affirmed it himself. But it, to my mind, didn't make any sense that we would actually do this. Yes, we would need a resolute response, but no, we couldn't risk World War III over this kind of scenario. And that's why I call my book The Senkaku Paradox. Not quite as good as Escaping the Doomsday Machine, but the same idea. The paradox is, if we wake up and this has happened one day, we're going to need to respond in some way. And our treaty obligations make it seem like we should treat this piece of Japanese territory like any other piece of Japanese territory, like Tokyo, like the major inhabited islands of Japan. Because there's no distinction in the U.S.-Japan Mutual Security Treaty between relatively more important and less important pieces of territory. They're all important. And if we have decided that the U.S.-Japan Treaty applies to the Senkaku Islands, presumably we would have to fight to defend Japan's control of those islands. But the paradox is, doing that would seem to make no sense to me, at least, because we're risking World War III over a place where no one lives, which has no economic importance, and where we have no government view as to whose islands they really should be in the first place anyway. So then I turned my attention with this same imagination, same thought process, to the Baltic states and Europe. And we all know what's been going on with the Russians and the Baltic states, and more generally, Russia's role in Eastern Europe. But very quickly, to review the bidding, the Baltic states were forcibly annexed into the Soviet Union in 1941. The United States never acknowledged or recognized that annexation. At the end of the Cold War and the end of the Soviet Union, they became independent countries. In the early Well, Berlin Wall, of course, fell in 1989. We're coming up on 30-year anniversary of that. And then the Baltic states had their full independence when the Soviet Union dissolved at the end of 1991 into 1992. And then President Bush, with Secretary of State at that time Colin Powell, decided in 2002 and brought along the rest of the NATO membership in thinking that we should bring the Baltic states into NATO. And by this point, the NATO alliance had already expanded under President Clinton, even though the Cold War was over, and you all know the story, and you all know the logic, because the United States didn't think it was right that Poland and the Czech Republic and Slovakia and Hungary and all the other Eastern European countries that were forcibly brought behind the Iron Curtain, we didn't think it was right that they should have their destiny controlled by Moscow once the Cold War ended. And we saw an opportunity to use NATO, along with the European Union, along with other mechanisms, to try to help strengthen democracy in these countries. So first Bill Clinton and then George Bush started bringing in a lot more members into NATO. And today, as many of you will know, we have 29 members of NATO, which is almost a doubling of the size of NATO relative to what it was at the end of the Cold War. At the end of the Cold War, in 1989, we had 16 members of NATO. And during the Cold War, we had not really been expanding NATO very much at all. After the original 1949 Washington Treaty, we brought in, that involved 12 countries, almost all of them in Western Europe, touching the Atlantic Ocean, or Canada and the United States. Over the course of the Cold War, we added Greece and Turkey, Germany and Spain. That's it, four countries in 40 years. But since then, we've added 13. And we view this as a way of building democracy, strengthening Europe, and for some people, creating a little bit of an insurance policy in case Russia ever got aggressive again. And there was a lot of bipartisan support in this country, and probably, I'm sure, in this room, for that expansion process. And in 2002, we invited the three Baltic states into NATO, which meant that now we have the so-called Article 5 guarantee that protects them as well. NATO is a mutual defense treaty organization, first and foremost. It's a military alliance. Attack on one is an attack on all. That's the fundamental plank in NATO. And all the stuff about promoting democracy and a community of nations is, I think, sort of secondary to that core military purpose. And so now we are sworn with the potential blood of our fellow Americans to defend the Baltic states, as well as Romania, Bulgaria, Hungary, all the other countries I've mentioned, countries that have been brought into NATO, Montenegro, Macedonia, soon, and not yet any of Scandinavia, or I should say not yet Finland and Sweden. Norway's been in for a long time. So I got thinking, okay, Vladimir Putin, he likes to play risk. He likes to play risky, and he likes to play the game of risk. And he's doing it from Syria to Ukraine to Georgia. But you know what? None of those countries are NATO members. But he has caused some disruption inside of Estonia in 2007. The Estonians brought down a statue dedicated to the sort of notional Soviet soldier of World War II. The Estonians decided they didn't want that. They brought it down, and the Russians mounted a big cyber attack 9 years before they tried to interfere with our presidential election here in the United States. And so on and so forth. There have been threatening military exercises, other sorts of maneuvers. And then in 2014, the Russians articulated a new doctrine which said, we have the right to protect native Russian speakers wherever they might be threatened, on Earth. Some people have pointed out that could perhaps even include Brooklyn, depending on, or maybe even Naples. I hope not Naples. But Vladimir Putin and his cohorts wanted to send out this doctrine, which frankly sounds sort of like our Monroe Doctrine in some ways. Sounds a little bit American. Maybe that's part of why Russians and Americans don't always get along. We've got a little bit of, I'm not comparing us to Vladimir Putin, but I do think that there's a common sense of great purpose in the world. And for the Russians, I think it's often pretty cynical these days. But nonetheless, they felt they had a right to articulate this doctrine. And so I got thinking about other scenarios. There's this guy, General Richard Sheriff, brilliant English general, who was the Deputy Supreme Allied Commander in Europe until about 4 or 5 years ago. And he wrote a very good book that I recommend called War with Russia. And he wrote it as a novel, but it's not meant to be a novel so much as a warning. And I would recommend any of you, it's pretty good beach reading, frankly, but it's also pretty scary. It's not the best bedtime reading because you probably won't sleep after you've read it. But his scenario involves the complete Russian annexation of the Baltic states, all of which are small and only meagerly defended by their own militaries. The collective strength of those three countries, Estonia, Latvia, and Lithuania, the collective population is less than 10 million, and the collective military strength is 30,000. So against the Russian military, they don't really have a chance on their own. That's why they want it to be in NATO. But we only have 5,000 Western European and American forces anywhere close. So 30,000 local forces, 5,000 U.S., Canadian, German, British, French, etc. That's all we got from eastern Poland over to the Baltics. So my scenario is the following. Vladimir Putin decides to have some fun with us. I don't think he's going to take a whole Baltic state because I don't think Putin is quite that risk prone. That would be pretty dangerous. We've got an Article 5 commitment. If we see a country overrun that's been a sworn treaty ally, I think we probably would and should respond with a full military counterattack, even though that would risk nuclear war. So I would support that. But by the way, your government does, whether you like it or not, because we already brought them in during the Bush administration into NATO. But what I got more nervous about was, what if Putin decides to create a little disturbance just over the border in one small town in eastern Estonia or eastern Latvia? Those countries have direct borders with Russia. They have about 25% Russian population, a Russian-speaking population each. And what if he finds a town, 100 people, dairy farmers, nobody else really around, and he manufactures some kind of a crisis? Maybe even sends in the FSB or the GRU to kill one of the Russians pretending to have been a native Estonian or Latvian speaker. So now we've got a pretext for the little green men who took Crimea in 2014 to come into eastern Estonia or eastern Latvia. What do we do? What do we Americans do? You might say, this is crazy talk. You know, you're up there pretending you're Tom Clancy. You're Tom Clancy without the talent. You know, give me a real scenario that I have to worry about. My judgment is that these are the real scenarios that we have to worry about, because I don't think China is going to attack Tokyo. And I don't think Russia is going to seize an entire Baltic state. These are countries that don't really doubt our willingness to defend our allies if their very survival is on the line. And they know we have the best military on Earth and we have nuclear weapons. But I think what they would love to do is poke and prod and create provocation. And then watch and see what happens, especially, let's say, inside of NATO. So what do you think NATO would do, 29 countries, if all of a sudden Russian green men have taken one little eastern town in Latvia or Estonia overnight? Nobody's gotten killed except for that Russian speaker that the Russians are claiming to have been killed by an Estonian or a Latvian native. But in reality, we know, or we suspect it was the Russian intelligence that did it to create a false pretext for this incursion. What do we do? Well, I actually love to do this as an interactive survey and see what different people in the room would like. Because we could try to do Desert Storm on steroids, send several hundred thousand U.S. ground forces backed up by air power into Eastern Europe. By the way, we only have about 75,000 total U.S. military personnel in all of Europe today. And most of them are in Germany, Italy, and the United Kingdom, nowhere close to the scenario that I'm talking about. And so we could build up, take a few months, try to send a big force. But are we going to save the village or destroy it, or destroy it to save it? And what are the nuclear risks associated with this? Well, long before we make our own decision as Americans, we're going to have to also persuade NATO allies. NATO decides by consensus, which, by the way, is one of the reasons I was against expansion. If you hadn't picked that up already implicitly in my earlier comment, one of the reasons I always thought we were being sloppy in how many little countries we were bringing into NATO is it slows down the decision-making gears, and it makes it much harder to reach a consensus, especially now with people like Hungary's leader, Orbán, and others in the alliance who probably don't even belong there in some ways, and not really friendly to classic Western values. But if it takes us weeks or months to decide what to do, Vladimir Putin is going to love it. Because what's his real goal in this scenario? His real goal, I think, is to actually destroy NATO. Not by a war, but by creating an internal existential crisis that has all of NATO wondering, what are we even here for if we're no longer willing to defend the territory of our own nations when they're attacked? And I think he might just enjoy trying to provoke that debate with all the ensuing consequences that could result. And if you think Donald Trump had some ammunition in 2016 to talk about NATO's failings, imagine a scenario in which NATO allies are not only spending far less than we are on their militaries, but they're failing to honor their pledge to defend each other. So this is why I worry about this scenario. And even if Putin doesn't do it, what about the guy after Putin, who might be just as angry with the West, just as intent on weakening Western institutions like NATO, but not have the cunning and ultimately the intelligence of Putin? I think Putin's a pretty bad guy, and I'd use worse language if we weren't being recorded, but I don't think he's stupid or completely reckless. I think he likes a certain amount of risk, but he wants to control and manage the risk. That's why he went into Syria only after watching President Obama not really go into Syria for 4 years. That's why he attacked pieces of Ukraine and Georgia, knowing that we had decided not to bring them into NATO, but that someday we thought maybe we would. Perfect moment, perfect opportunity under those circumstances for Putin. So I don't think he's going to just take Latvia, but I think he might try to take that one town. Or for the Chinese, the motivation is a little different. Why would the Chinese grab a Senkaku Island? They don't really think it's worth that much. They don't really want to use it as a springboard to attack Okinawa, I don't think. But they would love to shove it a little bit in Japan's face, because they still have not accepted that Japan is genuinely apologetic or remorseful about World War II. And China feels, coming out of its century of humiliation, starting with the Opium Wars of the mid-19th century, going through the failed Boxer Rebellion, the Communist Revolution, the Japanese imperial conquest and occupation, the Japanese brutalities during the 30s and 40s. The Chinese are still, as I think many of you know quite well, still not at peace with Japan, the way that Europe has largely accepted post-Nazi Germany. Very different kind of dynamic in the Western Pacific. And so I think there's a chance that China would like to weaken Japan and weaken the U.S.-Japan alliance, and throw a lot of doubt into Japanese minds about just how reliable we Americans would be in defending more serious aggression against Japan, and then get a little bit of historical payback at Japanese expense for some of these settlements of the pre-World War II order, when Japan really had taken over a large fraction of the Western Pacific and Eastern Asia. And in China's mind, maybe Japan still hasn't fully addressed that history. So I've spent half my talk just motivating the military scenario, but I think it was worth using my time that way, because if I don't explain why I'm worried about these scenarios, you're not going to be very interested in what I think we should do about them. If they just seem like some artifacts of some crazy woolly-headed think tank guy from Washington, you know, again, Tom Clancy without the talent of Tom Clancy, it's not going to seem very compelling. But I think these scenarios are the most worrisome things we have to address in thinking about Russia and China, at least their military machines. We have a lot of worries about Russian attacks on our democracy, disinformation, a lot of worries about Chinese intellectual property theft and cyber attack. But in terms of what they might do with their classic military forces, these are the scenarios that worry me. So I should also say that they worry almost everybody else in some version of some scenario. seems to worry almost everybody else in the U.S. national security community these days, as we all honor and celebrate the service of our national good friend, Secretary Jim Mattis, and most of us regret that he's now probably already in an equally sunny place to this. Good for him, bad for us, as I see it. I hope somebody can do the job half as well as he did, but he also was worried about China and Russia, and he made the re-emphasis on great power competition the centerpiece of his national defense strategy, which came out last January. So I think many of you know we do these fairly annual, or excuse me, every four-year sort of reviews of U.S. national security policy. The first one is supposed to be the U.S. national security strategy, and that came out in December 2017. H.R. McMaster was then national security advisor and orchestrated that. January of 2018 was the national defense strategy, and then February of last year was the nuclear posture review. And now we're waiting on the missile defense strategy. There are a few others that are still coming out. But Secretary Mattis, in this national defense strategy, he said, we got to somehow pull ourselves away from distractions in the Middle East and focus more on China and Russia, because we are losing our edge in great power competition. And if we don't restore it, or at least prevent further erosion, we're going to be in trouble. China's got a $200 billion a year military budget, and it's doubling roughly every decade because it's sort of tied to the size of their economy, and their economy has been doubling at least every decade, slowing down a little bit now, but still 6.5% a year. If you have 6.5% a year growth, it takes you 11 years to double. And that would mean by 2030, the Chinese could be spending more than $400 billion a year on their military. We spend $700 billion, but we're sort of spreading it all over the world. A little bit in Europe, a little bit in Asia, a little bit in the Middle East. The Russians and the Chinese don't have that problem. The Chinese focus their military efforts on the Western Pacific almost exclusively. The Russians focus theirs on a swath of territory coming from roughly northern Russia, past the Scandinavian countries, past the Baltics, down to roughly Syria and the Middle East. That swath of territory is where almost all of their attention and energy have been going. So we've got to somehow deal with these global challenges with a budget that no longer is quite as overwhelmingly superior to China's. Russia, its budget is only about 50 or 60 billion a year, so less than a tenth of ours, but they have 5,000 nuclear weapons. They have internal lines of communication, and they have the advantage of this very wily, cunning, and risk-prone leader who can decide where to make the next move. So that's why Mattis was worried. And I went to his speech last January when he announced this national defense strategy, and one of his famous lines from that speech was, "We have to do this. You might think it's unaffordable, but we can afford survival. We can afford survival as a nation." I'm not here to preach to you about whether we need a $700 billion a year budget to survive. That may have been slightly hyperbolic rhetoric. Mattis was pretty good at finding a good phrase, and I almost always admired the phrase. In this case, I thought it was a little strong, but his overall point is the important thing here, and his overall point was very reflective of where American national security strategy and thinking had been going in the last 5 to 10 years, as I think many of you are aware. So we have this problem together, and what I decided to try to do in the book was to identify where this could actually lead to war. Because, you know, China and Russia rising in the abstract, it doesn't produce war. Wars have to begin out of a spark or a problem in some specific place or over some specific issue. And that's why I wrote the Senkaku Paradox. So, coming back to now, what should we do if we have to face the question that General Whistler faced with the Japanese journalist? We've awakened to a world in which China has taken a Senkaku Island, or Russia has invented a pretext to put its little green men more or less non-violently into one of the towns in eastern Estonia or Latvia and sort of take over that town. What do we do? And as you've heard me say, I don't really favor a major, abrupt, direct, frontal assault as a military counterattack, because I don't think the stakes would be worth that kind of risk. And frankly, I'm less and less sure that we would win, because we're picking a geography that's designed to be advantageous to Russia or China. That's why they chose the attacks in this scenario in the places they did. They didn't choose them to be in Australia or Indonesia or Africa. They chose them to be right next to their own territory. And these are the places that Russia and China care about the most. We Americans have global interests. China is probably developing some more global interests. But historically, both China and Russia have primarily had regional interests. And now they also have quiet submarines, Kilo class and others. They have ballistic missiles. When, 10 years ago, when I first had the good fortune to visit you in Naples, most of these ballistic missiles were sort of like Saddam Hussein's Scuds. You fire them up in the air, you hope they come down within a couple football fields of where you were aiming, and if they just have a conventional warhead on top, in a worst-case scenario, they might kill a couple dozen people. And some of you may remember, we lost 28 people in one Scud missile attack in Operation Desert Storm in 1991. It was the single greatest loss of life the United States suffered. But back then, that was Saddam Hussein just throwing up a bunch of missiles and hoping for the best. And that's essentially where some of the Chinese missile forces were, let's say, 20 years ago. Today, China has ballistic and cruise missiles that can actually, if they're given correct guidance by satellite, they can actually track home and attack our aircraft carriers moving at sea. Not to mention our bases on Okinawa, mainland Japan, other parts of the broader Western Pacific region, or in the case of Russia, some of the air bases in Eastern Europe. Chances are that in Europe in particular, because we have so many allies, most of them are not spending enough on their militaries, but they still have a lot of military capability, a lot of military bases, a lot of geographic depth. If need be, we could patiently build up forces and sort of roll across Europe in whatever way we ultimately needed to, even if the Baltic states themselves were hard to reach because Russia had shut down a lot of the Baltic Sea, a lot of the ports. But imagine the difficulty of that operation. And in the Pacific, I think there's a decent chance that China would be able to sink some of our aircraft carriers and make some of our land bases in the region unusable. Now, as I try to do very simple mathematical modeling of where this could go militarily, we would have some things we could do as well. We could try to sink some of the Chinese submarines. We probably would not do that well, but with ballistic missile defense. We could shoot down some of their ballistic missiles, but they've got 1,000. Overall, I think the offense is going to have the advantage in this kind of exchange. They're going to use cyber attack to try to shut down our systems, and probably some of them will at least temporarily malfunction because of that. They're going to use anti-satellite weapons, of which they now have a number, to take down some of our satellites. We're going to try to take down some of their satellites, or at least jam them. But then they're going to have, and we have, a lot of small satellites, which could be a backup and are very hard to take down in their entirety. So we're going to be living in a world in the Western Pacific in which both sides are seeing and shooting at each other's major assets. And if you are above ground with big assets in this fight, I don't think you're in a good place. You want to be in stealthy aircraft. You want to be undersea in quiet submarines. You want to be shooting very fast hypersonic missiles. You don't really want to be mounting a big U.S. classic amphibious assault or big armada operation sailing into the Western Pacific. It's going to be very hard to make that work. And even if it might work, we have to ask, are the losses that we could suffer worth it for the stakes that I'm talking about? And even if you think they are, do you think the Chinese or the Russians would accept defeat rather than consider escalation to a nuclear attack? I don't mean on the United States mainland directly necessarily, but against our naval assets in the region. So I got very worried thinking about this scenario. The paradox is we have to do something, but the logical response leads to potential doomsday machine. And so we're in a conundrum. So the final part of my argument is trying to propose at least some rough guidelines for what we should do if any of these ugly scenarios actually happen. And by the way, I try to think about Taiwan scenarios here as well. Taiwan scenarios are a little different. China attacking Taiwan, because as you know, China claims Taiwan and would not want to see it move towards independence. 23 million people live on Taiwan. We no longer recognize Taiwan because of changes that happened under Carter and Reagan, but we still have sort of a soft obligation to help Taiwan with its defense. So that's another issue we can come back to in discussion if you wish. But let me just say for now that some of the main parameters of how I would think we could respond include the following. So let me just focus on the Baltic state scenario for a moment, and we can broaden the discussion, if you like, in the discussion period. If we wake up to this world, I think the first thing we do is start to move small numbers of American forces into the various towns that Russia did not take, but which are close by. So we start to work with our Latvian, Estonian, Lithuanian, and NATO partners, and we start to create a forward tripwire, if you will, that gradually can grow into a frontal line of defense. We should probably tell Russians that we are coming to establish a defense, not to launch an attack. I'm not trying to propose Vladimir Putin would deserve any favors or reassurance, but I want to reduce the odds that he shoots at these people, because the whole idea here is to reduce the odds of World War III without losing any more territory. So one part of the strategy is prevent further loss of territory. If it was the Senkaku Islands, there are 8, I would probably propose putting U.S. and Japanese forces on the other 7, for example. Not worry yet about what to do with the 8th. So that's part one. Part two of the strategy is to make China or Russia pay a high enough economic price that this looks like a crazy proposition, what they have just done. And here, President Trump is doing me a favor in my book publicity, because a lot of what he's trying to do right now with China and what the Congress was previously doing with Russia foreshadows the kinds of steps that I think would be needed in these kind of scenarios as well. And you've got a lot of options, especially towards Russia. Yes, Europe depends on Russian gas and oil, but Russia still needs to be in the world economy more than we need Russia. And Russia cannot easily survive economic war with the Western world if we're in this together with our allies. I'm not suggesting that we have to win an economic war quickly. My main goal would be to make sure Putin pays a high enough price that he doesn't get any ideas about doing even more. And some of you may say, Putin's not going to be deterred by an economic war or by sanctions. Well, you know, he might have already been deterred by economic sanctions, because ever since he moved into Crimea and eastern Ukraine in 2014, the European Union has imposed strong sanctions on him. They're gradually eroding, but still, Putin hasn't done anything more beyond those initial areas of conflict to speak of, except for the naval problem recently, which is right next to Crimea. But he's basically been content with Crimea and eastern Ukraine, and I think he's partially deterred, realizing we are more capable of a response than he might have thought, and these economic responses could really hurt him. So far, we have not denied most Russian companies access to American banks. So far, we have not denied most Russian banks access to the SWIFT banking system. So far, we have not done an energy embargo, or boycott, I should say, and that would require a lot of help for European friends to find alternative energy. But there is enough energy in the global market today that some degree of sanctions could be imposed, some degree of restriction on European imports of Russian gas and oil, that I think when you work through the mathematics, Europe is in a better place to survive that sort of economic war than Russia. So a lot of the book is an attempt to try to sketch out which different types of economic responses we have that we could make unilaterally, but also as an alliance, to make sure that Russia and or China pay a high enough price so that over time, They don't continue the aggression, and they certainly don't expand the aggression, and perhaps they even reverse the aggression. But I'm beginning the argument with a view that we actually do not have to reverse the aggression to be successful. We are in a very strong position strategically. These are relatively unimportant pieces of land. The only reason they're important is if they somehow give Russia or China the sense that we have lost our will, we have lost our way, and we're not going to respond if they do even worse things down the road. So the essence of the argument is to make sure we respond such that things don't get worse. One very last piece, and I'll stop. I also, in thinking about the Taiwan scenario in particular, I thought about ways in which we might use limited amounts of military force elsewhere, not at the initial aggression, not over the Senkaku Islands, not over the Baltics, but to try to reinforce the economic sanctions strategy and the economic warfare strategy that we had announced and intended to carry out. And I think this opens up some very interesting possibilities of how you try to attack shipping coming out of the Persian Gulf if you know oil tankers might be headed for Russia. That takes some, it's not easy to figure out which ones are headed for Russia. There's some doing and some tracking that needs to be instituted. The sanctions may get more effective over time as you figure out who is doing the trade with Russia or China, especially for China and oil. For Russia, it's going to be more manufactured goods from the West. So some of these strategies may involve limited amounts of U.S. military force, but applied where we have the advantage, not where Russia or China has the advantage, and applied with a specific purpose to reinforce the economic sanctions, thereby hopefully lowering the chance of escalation. Because my goals here are to prevent World War III first and foremost. And yes, I want to punish Russia or China enough that they stop doing what they've been doing. But in the first instance, the goal here is actually not victory per se, as we've historically defined it. The first goal is to make sure nothing even worse happens. Now, if these things play out, our relationship with Russia or China is going to change forever. And a lot of what Donald Trump is doing now towards China, we're probably going to do in spades. We're going to start not only imposing tariffs, we're going to start preventing Western firms from developing global supply chain relationships with Chinese producers of various goods. We're going to start permanently preventing investment by Chinese companies and banks in the United States. There are a lot of places this strategy would take you down the road if you did not get resolution over the initial aggression. But you don't actually have to deal with all of that initially. What you have to do, I think, is create this tripwire so things don't get worse, and then start to apply our strengths in the economic realm to wage a patient form of economic warfare that sets up strong deterrence against anything worse happening. Footnote, and I really am done. Some of you are thinking, what can they do to us in response? And I think we have some vulnerabilities, and we're going to have to get after some of those. For one thing, I believe we have to make sure we do not develop such great dependency on Chinese producers of intermediate goods that in any strategic sector, Chinese firms would have more than, let's say, 30 to 50% of market share for our incoming component production. Today, I don't worry so much, but we've got to have strategies that we don't develop even worse dependencies down the road. So you want to look across electronics, semiconductors, many other aspects and elements of the modern economy, cell phones, make sure we don't develop dependencies, because we have to anticipate that if we apply these economic responses, China's going to retaliate. And we've got to be capable of having escalation dominance, to take a strange Lovian term, against the Chinese in the realm of economic warfare. And it's going to take some greater doing because we're getting a little soft in thinking this way. We used to think this way in the Cold War. Today, we at least have to start doing the preparation, even if we don't actually apply the methods of economic warfare yet, because the Senkaku scenario has not yet happened. We need to be ready to think about it and apply it if need be. We also have something called the National Defense Stockpile, which is strategic minerals, like the rare earth minerals that China prevented Japan from buying a few years ago for a time. We've got to build up greater stockpiles in those areas. I'm not trying to sound like a latter-day Cold Warrior who's trying to call everybody to arms over the Senkaku Islands, but if we do some preparation, relatively modest things right now, I believe the kind of scenarios that Jim Mattis was most worried about, or at least I think should have been most worried about in his tenure, I think these scenarios will become much less likely. And we'll still have to keep an eye on Russia and China, but the likelihood of the kind of war that they really could credibly decide to initiate will have been reduced quite a bit. So I look forward to your reactions and your thoughts and your questions as well. Thank you.
There are microphones in the aisles, your left and your right.
Thank you for your interesting presentation. Just two quick questions. One in Asia involving the Japanese rare earth find, which is supposed to be in the multi-trillions. And in the Middle East, Israel's Leviathan natural gas field and their contracts with Egypt, Cyprus, and Greece. Thank you.
I might have to ask for a clarification on the first question.
It's fairly well documented that Japan has discovered a multi-trillion dollar rare earth find in their territorial waters. Thank you.
So let me just comment on the Japan-China issue, if you don't mind, I'll emphasize that, and the question about territorial waters. So many of you know that Japan and China have an ongoing disagreement about where their undersea resource line of demarcation should be drawn. And under the Law of the Sea Treaty, there is ambiguity when normally you would just think, well, why don't we just draw the line right smack between the two countries? And that's what you would do, except that China claims that its natural extension of the continental shelf goes out 100 miles or more. And under the Law of the Sea Treaty, in theory, that can become sort of the equivalent of a coastline, so that you would then think about drawing a line where the continental shelf ends, where the shallow water ends, or at least using that as one of your guides. So you get much different interpretations of where the resource division should change over from China to Russia. And I think that's where your question, sir, becomes most important, at least for strategic reasons. For economic and technological reasons, let's see if we can find it. Let's wish the Japanese good luck. But if they find resources that are also in land or in undersea areas claimed by China, then this issue will really come to the head that it has not so far. So far, there's been a dispute, but no one's really cared because everybody can fish in the fishing waters. And the undersea territorial issue, the seabed, has not been economically exploitable. My own view is that if we got to a place where Japan and China were fighting over whose interpretation of the dividing line on undersea resources should be drawn, that's also a scenario where we should be reluctant to get drawn in quickly militarily, even if shots start getting fired. And again, it's sort of a little bit against our, the last 30 years we've thought of war as all or nothing, right? When we Saddam Hussein, North Korea, we've got all these relatively small nemesis, the Taliban, Muammar Gaddafi. And I think we have to not only change the way the Pentagon starts thinking about and investing in modernization, we've got to expect that the next time there's a war, absolute and unconditional surrender by the enemy is not the correct goal. Because to get to that point would risk nuclear exchanges that are not worth the stakes. So that's the spirit of my whole book and presentation. And so in the first instance, I would be very reluctant, even though Japan's our treaty ally, I would be very reluctant to being shamed by the Japanese, God bless them, into coming quickly to their military aid if they want to have a fight with China over that. I'd be more inclined to want to draw it out, slow it down, and even... I'm not suggesting you concede that China be aggressive, but if they're sort of both enforcing their claims simultaneously, then my instinct would be to try to find a way to call off the shooting for a while and get this to some kind of an arbitration rather than risk World War III.
Bob? As you pointed out, Putin is not a stupid man. He's a very canny guy, and he enjoys creating fissures in the Western alliance, anywhere he can. NATO, I'm thinking of in particular. And it seems as though the present administration is playing right into his hands by talking down NATO, or at least talking our role down in NATO. Where do you see that going? Is NATO not still a bulwark against this incursion by Putin and by the Russian powers that be?
Yeah, thank you. And I'd like to take just a minute to explain my overall thinking on where I think we should go with Putin otherwise. I've given the military planning, but in response to your question, I think there is some worry that Putin will continue to use a combination of devious methods as a threat to the Baltics, and certainly as an ongoing way of disrupting Ukraine, and maybe even some other non-NATO members in Eastern Europe. So I think we're going to have strategies that I have not really talked about today to compete with him in information warfare, in cyber resilience, in protection of innocents abroad or at home. You know, he's willing to play chess in many different ways. But I also think, and maybe I'll give more detail on this in a second after hearing Mimi's question, but I also think that we have to reconceptualize our future vision for European security. Because right now, we still intend, as a matter of official U.S. policy, we still intend to bring Ukraine and Georgia into NATO someday. And I'm sure many people here would support that as a way to help defend these victims of Russian aggression. But I think it's a bridge too far for NATO. And I worry that it's not even something we can fully back up with our military. Georgia is not even in Europe. Georgia is across the Black Sea in Asia. NATO is supposed to be for European and North American countries. And so I actually think we need to create a more clever concept for a neutral zone in Eastern Europe. And Russia will have to agree to stop attacking these countries and let them join any other organization they might want someday if they wish and if they're invited. But we would agree not to bring them into NATO. To me, that's the architecture that I believe we should be thinking about, even as we also harden our own military defenses against Russian aggression. I'm not sure if that did a very good job with your question. The acoustics are a little hard, so I didn't necessarily catch every word.
Another thing that he has to be enjoying is the is Brexit, the breakup of the economic unity or solidarity of the West.
That's true. Although I bet you one thing he's not enjoying is that the sanctions are still in place. And if you're Vladimir Putin in 2016, 2017, Donald Trump wins in the United States, Orban is president of Hungary, Erdogan is president of Turkey, the polls are moving to the right in a sort of, you know, semi-non-democratic way. Marie Le Pen is doing well in polls in France. The Dutch are showing some, you know, tendencies in a pro-Russian direction even. And then, 2019, the sanctions are still in place. So we should give ourselves and our European friends some credit that despite all these setbacks, we have not gotten soft and not gone soft on Russia's aggressions towards Europe. That gives me some reason for hope.
Thank you.
Crimea and eastern Ukraine, fresh in everyone's mind, yeah. Reasonably so. What could we have done differently, and what would it have looked like?
Yeah. By early 2014, you could say a lot of the, you know, the goose was cooked, or les jeux sont faits, I mean, whatever your favorite expression. At that point, by the time we got into early 2014, it's pretty late to prevent those. But the immediate Maidan crisis in Ukraine was something where Putin's buddy, Yanukovych, thought that he could clamp down on these dissidents. And then, of course, we saw the protest, and then we saw Russia help the Ukrainian military assassinate some of its own citizens in clamping down on the protest. And then there was a deal around February 21st in which Yanukovych was going to be expected over time to step down, and we essentially helped certify that deal. And then Yanukovych felt that he had to flee the country, and he was essentially booted out, and that was the immediate prelude. So you could go back and argue that we should have worked harder to encourage the Ukrainian resistance to honor the deal with Yanukovych. But I don't know if we had more than a few hours for that to really have happened at that point. So going back in time, and in the spirit of my friend's question over here, right after the Cold War, I would have wanted to create a new European security architecture that would keep NATO, but that would invite new members into a separate organization, which could be linked to NATO, but would not be quite as much in Russia's face. It was not the team that beat you in the Cold War, you know, quite as blatantly. And I really do think Russians had their pride offended, and that was much of the basis for what happened next. And so I was against the early expansion of NATO, even into Poland and the Czech and Slovak republics at that time. And you could have, each time you expanded further east, you could have reassessed. But we kept going. That was another set of decisions. I think we should have supported the democratic movements in the newly independent countries. I don't think Putin was right about that. I don't think we should have let him just sort of dictate which strong men were going to win. But we also should not, we made economic mistakes. We asked Boris Yeltsin to do shock therapy and just put up these great assets of the Russian state for sale to the highest kleptocratic bidder. And to us Americans, with our free market ways, it sounded like good economics. But in Russia, it was, you know, again, rewarding those who were the insiders, who had the connections, who had the money. And if you're a Russian citizen, watching what happens to your country in the 1990s, as much as you might have hated communism, what you see now is those great assets of Mother Russia being sold off to a few rich, unpleasant, you know, oligarchs who probably do not elicit the same kind of national pride in you that, you know, at least in the old days, it was all Russian citizens who had some claim on the railroad and the oil resources and the military machine and the greatness of Russia. And then that was all sort of dismantled. And we did a lousy job, in my opinion, with the economic reform strategies that we offered to the Russians in the 1990s as well, which is why Gorbachev and especially Yeltsin are completely unpopular in Russia. And even people who think that Yeltsin is a murdering son of a you-know-what, and he's killed a lot of Russians, or at least he's winked and nodded while people like Boris Nemtsov and Magnitsky and many others were either imprisoned or killed or both. And a lot of Russians know that, but they still like Yeltsin better than they like, or excuse me, they still like Putin better than they like Yeltsin, because Putin presided over the dismantlement of the state, and we were sort of encouraging that process along. So we made some big mistakes in the early to mid-1990s and then in the early to mid-2000s, in my opinion. Sorry to end on that note.
Thank you.